From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In one of the episodes of the new podcast, More Perfect, there are these two gut-wrenching moments where a little girl, the same little girl, is taken from her home. The show examines the complex legal issues surrounding the Indian Child Welfare Act. It's a law that was tested by the Supreme Court. The two scenes bookend the show, and they're brutal to hear play out, but they illustrate that behind the arcane jargon of these court cases, there are these powerful personal stories. It's the same approach the program Radiolab takes with science, which makes sense. More Perfect is a project created by Jad Abumrad and his crew at Radiolab. Today in the program, we're talking about More Perfect. Jad will join us to talk about the new show and the stories behind it. Join us after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's so much ceremony and mystery associated with the U.S. Supreme Court, it makes you feel for the reporters and try and cover it. The legal journalist Ellie Mistal says the High Court is the least transparent part of our government, and all the obscure precedents and jargon don't help. But Mistal is convinced there's a way to talk about what's happening in the court without making people's eyes glaze over. Jad Abumrad thinks so, too, because behind these arcane cases are personal stories, surprising stories. Jad and Ellie Mistal use these stories as the centerpiece for their new podcast. It's a mini-series that just started a few weeks ago. It's the first spinoff for the program Radiolab, and today in the program we're going to be talking about it with Jad and Ellie. Jad Abumrad, of course, is creator, host, and executive producer of More Perfect. He's the co-host of Radiolab with Robert Krulwich. Both are produced by WNYC Studios. Ellie Mistal will join us a little bit later in the program, so I'll introduce him in just a moment. But Jad Abumrad is joining us from WNYC in New York. And Jad, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it's great to be back, Doug. Thank you.
You've talked about how the Supreme Court in some way has always sort of fascinated you. How long have you been fascinated with the Supreme Court, and what do you figure it is about it?
I think, like a lot of people, I just don't understand how the Supreme Court works. I've always been really interested out of ignorance, mostly. Like, what do they do exactly? And then the things that they do get covered in this very wonky way that I don't quite get. But then I also have this deep sense that whatever it was that was just decided based on this thing called the Commerce Clause, which I don't even understand, that affects my life in some way. But I don't know how. So I've always had this sense of its importance and also its opaqueness. And that just felt like an invitation. But also, it's like the chance to do this show was the chance to sort of do the civics class I wish I had had but never had when I was growing up.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing that's fascinating about the Supreme Court is that whatever it is that America is at this moment, that's the place we go to fight about it.
Yeah.
That's the place we go to sort of really tussle about what is this country that we're living in? Who are we as a people? And who gets to decide who we the people are and who we the people aren't? All of that stuff gets fought out at the court. And so it just felt like I really need to understand what's happening in there as an American and also as a storyteller. Mm. It just felt like a really rich place to go to tell stories.
There was this piece you guys did on Radiolab. This was, I think, 2014, called 60 Words.
Yeah.
And it was this piece where you examine and you sort of break down the well, would you talk about this particular moment? Because I have to say, in some way, I remember taking note of the piece at the time thinking, is that Radiolab-y? Is that science? And it seemed like a departure in some way for you guys.
Yeah, it was. It was one of the first things that led to what we're doing now with More Perfect. I mean, first of all, I've always felt that Radiolab is a way of asking questions more than a particular topic.
Right.
And that story, the 60 words began with a really simple question, which is, okay, so on 9/11, this horrible thing happened, and we went to war. And we've been at war since then. We've been in the this is now the longest running war in American history. But the people that we're fighting the war against now are definitely not the same people who did that thing on 9/11. So how do we justify that? And it was a very simple question, and it turns out the justification for this war, the legal foundation for it, is one paragraph called the Authorization for Use of Military Force, the AUMF for short. And it is 60 words long. It's a tortured, tortured paragraph with like way too many commas and way too many, you know, subclauses or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
But this one sentence is the legal justification for this war. And I just – I was like, well, how is that? What in that sentence gives the president the right to do, say, drone strikes in Yemen when nobody in Yemen was responsible for the attacks at 9/11? So how do we make that leap? And it turns out if you look at that paragraph and you sort of deconstruct it almost word for word, sentence for sentence, you can see the way in which we as a country have slipped from a very narrowly defined war to a much, much broader – almost indefinite war.
Yeah.
And so it felt like a really important thing to be able to, just as an individual, to understand that paragraph and also just to communicate to our audience.
So you take that thing and you go backwards and you find the moment of transition, the sort of story associated with it?
Yeah, the moment of transition. And also, I mean, you know, there were stories to tell that we didn't know existed about when the AUMF was passed on September, I think I want to say 14th, 2011. It might have been a day or two later. There was unanimous support for it. But there were also a group of lawmakers who could see into the future, and they thought, uh-oh, if we pass this paragraph, this is going to be a slippery slope times 1,000. I don't think we should give the president this much power. And there was ultimately a vibrant debate in the basement of Congress, because at that point, if you remember, smoke was still in the air. Mm-hmm. Things hadn't settled. There was panic across the country. And when it came down to a vote, only one lawmaker, Representative Barbara Lee from Berkeley, I believe, only one person, voted no. She was the sole dissenting voice. And that was amazing to me that someone would have those kinds of convictions in that moment to say no. So we told her story. But then I think just as conceptually, it felt important to me to be able to look at a sentence like that as a lawyer might. And it turns out like when a lawyer reads a word like force, they read that word in a completely different way than a normal human would read it.
Yeah.
I mean, to a lawyer, the word force means all kinds of things. Like it turns out that you can you can justify Guantanamo Bay by the word force. That to use force against an enemy combatant, you and I would think, oh, that means send a soldier in to shoot him or send a bomb or something. But actually, to capture somebody and put them in prison is to remove them from the battlefield, and therefore it falls under the category of force. So it was amazing to me that like one simple word could justify legally the existence of Guantanamo Bay. I mean, that's amazing to me, and I feel like Americans should need to know that. We need to have that background.
At what point did you start thinking? We'll get to the baby girl story here in a moment, because I know that really was a catalyst for you thinking about doing this series. But at what point did you figure that maybe this particular piece? And maybe you didn't feel this way. Maybe it doesn't fit perfectly in Radiolab. We should do another show that explores another thing. Like, or did you figure, it fits fine in Radiolab?
You know, at this point, we've done like sports stories.
Yeah,
we've done,
true.
You know, law stories. We've done science stories. We've done stories that I wouldn't even be able to categorize. I don't really sweat the sort of like the category questions too much, whether this is in or out. I honestly feel like Radiolab is whatever we wake up and decide to think about that day. But when it came time to start More Perfect, maybe I got to the point where, I mean, you look at the conversation happening right now, and one of the phrases that you hear again and again and again with the election is, the single most important decision the next president will make is who will fill Scalia's seat, and then perhaps, Ginsburg's seat or whoever else goes vacant.
Totally.
Yeah. And I think to myself, how is it the single most important thing? Like, when did that happen? And if you ask that simple question, you realize that actually when the Supreme Court started, it was not what it is today. It was just a bunch of hacks in a basement. Like, they were not. Nobody anticipated that this would become such an important branch of our government. So how did that – where did it evolve? And so I began to have a lot of questions which felt so focused on the Supreme Court that in a way it warranted its own show to address. And it just so happened that Laura Walker, the president of WNYC Studios, was having the same thoughts at the same time.
Hmm.
And so she and I had a conversation and we were like, well, wow, maybe we should just – maybe this should be the first spinoff. Let's just go do it. And that set us on our path.
Let me introduce our other guest. Elie Mystal is with us. He's a contributing legal editor for More Perfect. He's also a breaking media editor at large for the blog Above the Law, Redline, and he's co-host of their podcast, Thinking Like a Lawyer. And Elie Mystal, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
I hope that gets better, that connection.
is that not great?
It's not great. Let's try to fix it, and we'll come back to you. Jed, let's talk about something else. Let's talk behind Ellie's back while we...
Yeah, let's talk smack about Ellie.
Let's talk smack. maybe we should start with this particular story. This is a case that sounds boring, like all Supreme Court cases do. Adoptive couple versus baby girl. And really, you've talked about how this was the one that kind of got you started, got you hooked on the kinds of stories you could tell about. Introduce us to this story, first of all, because I want to start working through some of the tape.
Sure. Sort of the quick backstory is that this was at a time in Radio Labs, 2012, where I was frustrated with the very thing we were just talking about. I was feeling that there are other stories we should be telling besides, you know, what happens in your brain when you have such and such thought. We were doing a lot of these like neuroscience stories, and I was getting frustrated. I wanted to sort of branch out. So at a certain point, I told the staff, I was like, all right, here's the Supreme Court docket for this year. I mean, look at some of these cases. Choose a case. Make a few calls. Let's see what happens. It was really just like a harebrained idea at that point. Our producer, Tim Howard, who has since gone on to work on an amazing podcast called Reply All.
At the time
he chose this case. It was called Adoptive Couple v. Baby Girl. It is a title that doesn't even make sense because it's like the adoptive couple is trying to adopt the baby girl. So how are they fighting? And none of it made sense.
Yeah.
But he makes a few calls. And initially it was just a custody battle. It was a couple's trying to adopt a young girl. But then somewhere in the stream of the adoption, the child's biological father rides in and negates the adoption.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that is sort of interesting in a kind of soap opera-y drama sort of way, but it didn't seem to be all that interesting as a story to tell. But then he makes a couple of calls, and what he finds out is that this case is the tiny tip of the iceberg, and underneath the water are huge questions about Native American history in this country and about Native American law.
All right, hold on, because I want to set this up first. I want to play this.
Oh, yeah,
first.
Go for it.
Because I think the first – because this is what's great. I mean, there are kind of these bookends in this show that are terrific, and both of them are this little girl being brutally stripped from her home. I mean, it's really hard to listen to. And I think if people remember this case, this was a couple of years ago when – people were kind of outraged that this is the Matt and Melanie Copabianco. They're Veronica's adoptive parents, and as you sort of talked about there, this scene plays out where this man, who is Veronica's biological father, is going to come and pick. Well, let me play this because it's great. It's Tim Howard talking about what he thought of the story at the time. It's sort of his initial impression. This is Adoptive Couple of the Baby Girl. It's from the new podcast, More Perfect.
New Year's Eve 2011. With cameras rolling, Dustin Brown drives his pickup truck into Charleston.
Matt and Melody Capobianco clutch to 2-year-old Veronica. This could possibly be the last time they hold their baby as her mom and dad.
And that evening, Veronica is transferred to Dustin.
I didn't feel like we had enough time for her to be not afraid when she's...
We left her with strangers.
Yeah, when she's... I mean, to her, they're complete strangers, and I can't imagine that she's not going to be terrified.
And as Dustin gets into the truck, holding his two-year-old daughter for the first time, a reporter asks him,
"Do you think this is in her best interest?"
And this is all you hear from him.
"I think so.
Let's get back, please.
We need to give her a
Thank
chance
you.
Again.
Have you ever seen the child before?"
They declined any further comment on camera.
He gets into the truck with Veronica, and they drive away, back to Oklahoma. Can I ask you, when was the last time that you spoke with Veronica?
The day after the transfer.
A phone call?
After. Yeah, we spoke to her for about 2 minutes, and we told her we loved her, and she said, "I love you, Mommy, and I love you, Daddy," and I don't know, just a few minutes, and but that was it. That was the last time we were able to be in touch.
And that was 16 months ago.
And how long was Veronica with them again before this happened?
About 2 years.
Oh, man, that's hard.
Yeah. And, you know, when I first heard about this case, that's basically the only way I thought of it, you know, is just,
yeah,
that's a crazy injustice. That's basically all I saw in it.
That's Tim Howard talking to Chad Abumrad. And that's sort of where we're left. I mean, I think that's the impression that most people sort of have. But then this sends him off into this rabbit hole he talks
about. Yeah, yeah. I mean, most of the coverage during that case was, how could this have happened? Yeah. How could a couple who went through all the legal procedures, you know, they did it the right way, how could they then have this happen to them? I mean, they had the kid for 2 years.
Yeah.
But what you soon discover is something kind of amazing, which is that the law that allowed – okay, so basically baby Veronica, it turned out, was born to a man with a very small percentage of Cherokee blood. And it was the – so Dustin Brown, who you heard a beat of, he was Cherokee. And there is a law that says that any child born to the Cherokee Nation for the most part must be kept in the Cherokee Nation.
Yeah.
And so he was able to use that law to basically – get custody of her after he had signed away his parental rights. So, okay, that still seems wrong. And then you go back into the history and you realize the reason that this law existed is that in the, I believe, 50s, 60s, and 70s, there was, and I think this is putting it mildly, there was an epidemic of abductions of children being removed from Native American reservations. There was sort of a political movement to rob these tribes of their sovereignty. And one of the ways that happened, one of the things that created was pressure on social services to go in to these places. And anytime they saw a house where the electricity was shut off, anytime they saw a house where, you know, it was a single parent, they would often remove the child. They would take them into custody, and then that child would end up in a white family. And there were reports of white families driving into these reservations and literally taking children from off the road and putting them in the car and driving away. Mm. There was this general idea through the culture that we have to save these kids from what was happening on the reservations. And so I think that the percentage was one out of every three kids was taken off the reservation.
25-30%, which is shocking.
Which is staggering to think about. I mean, and so this law was put in place to protect that, so that this would stop, and it did stop it. And so this case then becomes not about a custody battle, but about a law that's up at a slightly higher altitude. Should this exist? And then the sort of the idea above that, the bigger idea is, should these tribes have some kind of sovereign status that's separate from American law? And there are a lot of people who believe that they shouldn't. There are a lot of people who are offended by the idea of Indian law to begin with. And so what you realize as you go through this case and you peel back the layers is that this is actually a conversation about American history and about our relationship to the original Americans and their relationship to United States law. And so that every case, so this is what's amazing to me about the Supreme Court, is every tiny personal story is tethered to some very, very big ideas that have to do with culture and politics and history and basic ideas of Americanism.
And then the story comes around also to, and Melanie Coppa-Bianco asks this question. She says, all right, I get it. This law that was passed to protect these Native American children who are basically being kidnapped from their families. That's a she calls it a beautiful law, but what does that have to do with us? In the end, we're just going to lose our daughter that we've cared for 2 years now. And that really and it shows you just how complicated stories like these are.
Absolutely. And it's impossible not to feel for, I mean, one of the things we wanted to do in the story, because this has felt like the most honest version of the reporting, is that a listener has to identify with everybody.
Right.
Like the Coppa-Biancos, that is, what worse scenario could there be than what they went through? But at the same time, as you get to know the father, the birth father, who initially is sort of the villain, what you realize is that he was kind of tricked into signing away his parental rights. It wasn't something he had planned to do. He had never planned to be MIA. But somehow he was tricked, not too dissimilarly from the way a lot of parents on the reservations were tricked into giving away their kids. So you begin to see that actually his story is not separate from the history. It is in the history. It's part of the history. And so you begin to feel for him, you know, and then at the very end, when the case resolves, it's hard to know what to do with your sympathies, you know?
I don't want to give too much away about that story. Some people may have read about it, but you really need to go hear the piece. But let me play another moment, because this is Tim Howard, the report, one who reported this again. He goes and he meets with Dustin. And I don't think there were very many reporters who have actually talked to him, at least not at the time.
Yeah.
And Dustin did not want to talk. And it's kind of a great moment in the podcast when Tim actually reveals that he gets him, that he's able to actually go to Oklahoma and talk to him. But I think Tim, in this moment in the show, really kind of lays out how complicated all of this is. And you'll hear, of course, in the background, some of the sound associated with little Veronica, who's, of course, sort of the center of all of this.
Honestly, hanging out with her and Dustin in the backyard is really easy to forget all these people whose lives are just completely tangled up in this scene, but who aren't there? Christy Maldonado, the birth mom.
She did not intend to give Veronica up. She intended to give Veronica a life.
Matt and Melanie Coppa-Bianco.
I mean, this has been going on for so long. We've kind of been in a holding pattern for forever.
We're just waiting and waiting and waiting.
And of course, the hundreds of tribes who are just worried about their own kids.
Pretty cool. Are you a good swimmer?
Yes. I'm a good swimmer.
I'm a bad swimmer.
You're not. You're a good swimmer.
No, I'm a pretty bad swimmer.
No, you're not. You're a good swimmer.
Kind of a heartbreaking story in both ways. And that's what's kind of so tragically beautiful about it. I mean, as listeners, you feel swayed both ways. And in the end, tied up in knots. And maybe that's the idea, right?
Yeah, it is the idea. I mean, just to get highfalutin for a second, like Alexis de Tocqueville had this idea that like what is best about America is that like you can, Americans move through a series of identities but never identify with each one but never give in to any one.
Yeah.
You know? And I feel like that as a mission, that's, there's a very de Tocquevillian mission at the center of this project, which is we want to identify with all of these different voices. And particularly, that feels particularly important to me right now when like there's such division, you know? Mm-hmm. It's important to identify with each side but never give in to any one. And that that's what happens when you hear her voice in some way, for me, is that you identify so deeply with all these different perspectives, but you can't give in to anyone because that would be letting this girl down in some way.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Jad Abumrad, he's with us, creator and host of Radiolab's first spinoff series. It's called More Perfect. We have a link to it on our website. Ellie Mistal is contributing legal editor to the series. We'll try to get him back with us, even if it's by phone, after a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a new podcast. It's a spinoff of Radiolab. It's called More Perfect. It's focused on the Supreme Court, some of the most significant rulings in American history. But what has always made Radiolab great is what makes More Perfect work, too. It's that it's built around these amazing stories. Jad Abumrad, creator and host and executive producer of More Perfect, is joining us today. Ellie Mistal, also with us, a contributing legal editor to More Perfect, both joining us today. Ellie, I think my phone, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Good. All right. So it's better than nothing.
I'm so sorry. It's been a crazy day because, you know, there's the news today coming out of the court.
Let's say something about that. I mean, the Supreme Court, I guess, they're lacking a member, but they still were able to muster a majority in this case that struck down these Texas abortion restrictions. Ellie, you want to say something about that? Just maybe what that sort of in a larger sense tells us about the Supreme Court right now?
Right. And I think this is one of the things that we're trying to emphasize in More Perfect. People tend to think of the court as complete ideologues. And there is some of that. I mean, there are certain cases that do break down strictly along ideological lines based on which president nominated the justice. But a lot of times they break down along different lines. A lot of times they break down on legal lines or really narrow lines. And here today in the Texas abortion case called Whole Woman's Health, the Hellerstadt. We have a somewhat conservative justice, Anthony Kennedy, switching sides and voting with the liberal justices. But even more importantly to me, in this particular case, it really isn't a close 5-3 decision. Read a certain way, there's a 7-1 majority, a broad-based consensus that our previous abortion laws, our previous abortion decisions, are still good law. And there's a lot of support for that. So you can see that even though the decision kind of comes down 4-3 and it looks very contentious and ideological, on the law, there's a much broader consensus in this particular case.
Mm. That's a decent segue, I think, into this question of ideology and the point at which the Supreme Court jumps into the political thicket, which is the title of this piece. Jad, let's talk about this one. There's this audience question that comes. You were on this panel.
Yeah.
And this question, I want to play this question because I think it's such a great question. It really gets you started on this bigger examination. Let me just play this because I think it sort of speaks for itself.
Could you address what I see as the increasing politicization of the court, the apotheosis of which, I guess, was voting or electing Bush to be our president. Has the court always been this way? Is this just my perception that it's becoming more politicized?
Yeah, I mean,
jumping
it's a great question.
For you, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great question. I mean, Ellie, myself, and one other person, Jamie Floyd, had been doing this panel, and somebody asked that question. And it's a really interesting question because, I mean, you could slice that question a few different ways. You could say, when did the court get divided? And I think Ellie sort of spoke to that nicely, that if you go back, you will find like exchanges between the justices, which are a hell of a lot less civilized than they are now. So I actually think that the court is they're good. They're cordial in a way that they haven't been a lot of times. But they're if you ask, when did the court get into matters that are political? When did the court start to wade in? It turns out there is a very specific moment where you could argue like the Pandora's box got kicked open. And it goes back to a case called Baker v. Carr, which I believe was 1962. And it's one of those redistricting cases that is super easy to ignore and your eyes glaze over because, oh, it's like I have this thing with redistricting. I just find that it's really hard to care about.
Yeah.
But in this particular case, the justices were so aware of the historical precedent they were setting that one of them actually had a mental breakdown.
Yeah.
Like lost his mind, and another had a stroke. So this one case broke two justices because arguably they knew what they were doing to the future, and they felt the weight of that burden in a personal way. And so we tell the story of that case legally, what it was, and mm-hmm. what were the arguments on both sides, but also personally, who were these two justices, and why did it have this effect on them?
And just to get back to the ideological kaleidoscoping, one of the justices who was in this story, who was most against the court getting involved into the political thicket, as we put it, was actually appointed by FDR. You know, so when you think of kind of one of the heroes of modern liberalism, he appoints this guy who was very liberal, but his version of liberalism was to stay out of the political questions and let Congress and, at that point, the ascendantly powerful president decide how the law should go. So, again, you can kind of see that the court, yes, they are ideological, but their ideologies don't always follow the strictures of kind of our Democrat-Republican political process.
What I loved about this show, this particular episode, is how principled everyone was. Mm-hmm. Frankfurter, he is an a-hole for sure, and that's really part of the, I mean, that's part of the podcast, and what's it's yeah. the fascinating part of the story. He's a dink. William O. Douglas is a prick. So you've got one on the left side, one on the right side, and the podcast really goes through in sort of really funny ways just how much of a jerk these guys can be and were.
Yeah, yeah.
But super principled. And that was the thing that was. And then, of course, we should mention who Charles Whitaker is. Charles Evan Whitaker. Jed, mention him because he's now stuck in the middle.
Sure. Yeah, so, I mean, this was a moment where you had a very divided court. I mean, have there not been moments like that's just one of those, like, one of the moments where there's, you know, you had liberal bloc and your conservative bloc. And then a guy walks into the sort of fray named Charles Whitaker, who is, I guess you could call him one of the swing, I mean, maybe the swing vote. Yeah. He sort of leaned conservative for a while, but he was a guy, a super bootstrapper kind of guy. Like, yep. He grew up on a farm. He put himself through law school and high school at the same time, which is insane. He ends up being this, like, incredibly ambitious, hardworking guy, and rides his way up through the courts, becomes a judge, then he kind of goes up and up and up and up, and eventually is appointed to the Supreme Court. But he didn't have all of the sort of political science, philosophy courses that a guy like Frankfurter on the right or Douglas on the left would have had. And so he walks into the court really largely unprepared,
right,
and did not anticipate the level of just rancor between these two sides. And he becomes a real victim to it. I mean, he gets lobbied by one side and then the other side and the other side. And he doesn't feel like he can stand up to these sort of titan intellectuals. And so he agrees with one, then the other, and the other, and they knew he was sort of the, in a very, very loose way, he was sort of the Kennedy of that time.
Right.
Although I think there's a lot of problems with that analogy, but he sort of got he was in the middle pretty much always, and it was very painful for him. I mean, there are descriptions of the first year he was there, he lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
He was fidgety. He was like a kind of, I think he was having the early stage symptoms of very severe bipolar,
yep,
but it wasn't something that people knew a lot about at that time or knew how to treat. And that conservative-liberal divide, I think, became traumatic to him.
Yeah. Let me play a moment from the episode, because, I mean, the essential question comes to be whether or not the court should weigh in. And it was this Tennessee case, the Baker versus Carr, is this Tennessee case, and whether or not the Supreme Court should weigh in on this question of whether the state, Tennessee in particular, should redistrict. And everyone agreed it was probably not right. But should the high court make the ruling? And so Frankfurter is adamant that the court not weigh in. William O. Douglas is adamant in the other way. And so he's hearing all of this stuff. And after they have this, or I guess this comes after oral arguments, and the court is divided, and Frankfurter goes on and on and on. And this gives you a sense of what Whitaker is hearing. You'll hear in this clip Kate Whitaker, his granddaughter, and Kent Whitaker, Whitaker's son.
There was one account that I heard where Frankfurter went on
for 4 hours.
For hours.
Really lecturing Whitaker, really, really belittling him.
This guy.
Yes, it was horribly intimidating.
At one point, one of the justices on the liberal side, Justice Hugo Black, he took Whitaker aside.
Black was trying to make him feel better. And Black said to Charles Whitaker, just remember, we're all boys grown tall. We're not the gods who sit on high and dispense justice. But it's very difficult not to see yourself in that role.
Particularly if your vote might be the vote that decides everything.
This started to weigh heavily on Whitaker's mind. He was disturbed by having the weight of the Supreme Court on his shoulders.
According to his family, Kate and Kent,
my mother tells me that, you know, he at that time was under a lot of stress and spoke as though he were dictating, spoke his punctuation. Hello, Judith, comma, it's very nice to meet you. Clearly thinking about everything that he might say being recorded.
I remember his stating that he felt like all the words that he uttered were being chiseled in stone, as a result of which he said, you don't talk much.
You also heard Susie Lechtenberg in there, by the way, who reported this story for More Perfect. He goes...
Clarence Thomas not talking much.
Man, and so he almost goes mad. I mean, he...
Yeah.
That's what I loved about... I have to say, this has been such a great episode, I think, because it was so surprising and so personal. It's not like you don't deal with the essential question, but... To me, this was almost more about the personal story than the arcane legal question. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and what was fascinating to me is that they were one and the same. You know, like this guy's experience and the political question at large somehow converge in this one case.
And I wouldn't say that, you know, I don't think that is a sentiment that's lost to history. I don't think that's arcane at all. I think if you look at, for instance, Anthony Kennedy's decisions last year in gay marriage, in abortion, what you see is a person who is very concerned about his legacy. You know, make no mistake, Kennedy is a conservative. He's a Republican. But when it comes to individual rights and when it comes to potentially taking away individual rights from people, he seems deeply concerned and deeply thoughtful and in some ways perhaps deeply tortured about which way to go. I mean, Kennedy is a Catholic, and his vote has been the deciding vote for gay marriage. It's been the deciding vote for this recent upholding of abortion rights. So again, I don't think what Whitaker goes through, I don't think what any of these people go through 50 years ago is all that different than what they go through today.
And I find it very moving that description of him speaking in punctuation,
right?
Because you realize that sense that any action that you make as a Supreme Court justice will reverberate through time, and it will have effects on future generations that you can't predict. That's a lot of weight to carry as you're making decisions.
Even in dissent, our first episode was about the death penalty case, and you know, Breyer has been a dissenter in some of our recent death penalty hearings, but in dissent, he's trying to muster up support to potentially overturn the death penalty. Mm-hmm. So even when you're on the losing side, your words carry that same weight.
We'll talk about that case, actually, when we get back from a break. Utah plays a role in this story somewhat, and so we'll talk about that. Let me just say one final thing about, and Jed, maybe you can mention that really powerful scene where Whitaker, the court comes back from winter recess and he doesn't show up. He's in the woods. And it's a really powerful moment where he just, in the silence of this moment, is really powerful.
Yeah, I mean, do you want me to talk about it or should...
Yeah, say something about it because I want to play
yeah,
this.
Sure. Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you know, here what we know as reporters is very little, to be honest. We know that he went to a cabin and we know that he sat with a colleague by the lake and they would spend hours just sitting in silence. And every so often the justice would say, oh my God, I've got to get back. I've got to get back to work. And his friend would say, no, just chill out, man. Just hang out. Just relax. You know, get yourself together. We don't know what went through his mind, but we, as we were reporting the story and knowing the importance of this case, we sort of take a speculative journey into his mind. Like, what might he have been thinking at this moment as he was sitting by the lake, juggling two different ways of deciding this case and two different paths for history in a way.
He went to really what would be a cabin in the woods in the middle of Wisconsin, and he called up one of his former law associates in Kansas City to come up and join him.
And according to Craig Smith, he and this guy, whose name was Sam Mulby, they would just sit there on the bank of the lake in silence.
They would sit for hours on end, not talking to each other. Just waiting for the justice to speak.
There is no cause for pride in what has happened in Selma.
You know, we have no way of knowing what he was thinking at that moment, but I imagine he was just sitting there and he was thinking about these two realities that could unfold. Like, on the one hand, if the court stepped into politics, they could protect people.
Just Selma, Alabama became a shining moment.
You're to disperse. You're ordered to disperse.
But on the other hand, what kind of precedent would this set?
It's a sad day in America, Mr. President, where we can't...
Would it make the court too powerful? In which case, who would protect the people from the court? I imagine his mind went back and forth and back and forth.
And when Whitaker decided he really had to get back to work, then this protege would say to him, no, just relax. Just take it easy and get yourself together before you decide to go back.
Susie Lichtenberg, she is reporting that story for More Perfect. Jad Abumrad, creator, host, executive producer of More Perfect, is with us. Eli Mistal, contributing legal editor to the show. You can find a link to it on our website. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Jad Abumrad and Eli Mistal. We're talking about the new podcast, More Perfect, first spinoff from the program Radio Lab. Okay, so let's talk about Cruel and Unusual. This was number one in the first episode in the podcast. Jad, you start. What were the issues that you were interested in with this particular story?
This one was, I was interested as when we were doing this, we were sort of researching the show, I was interested in the words cruel and unusual. Personally, I find like the word unusual is fascinating. Like, you know, cruel is obviously an evolving thing. Like what was considered cruel 100 years ago is no longer considered cruel I said that the opposite. You know what I meant?
I do.
But the unusual like is... Like, what happens if it's cruel and usual? Like, does that, you know, so the Eighth Amendment is just bizarre. Mm-hmm. I was interested in that. But then Karen Duffin, a reporter who was part of our sort of founding team, she brought a story about a challenge to the death penalty, the constitutionality of the death penalty. That's sort of the death penalty is being attacked from many different angles. And one of the ways it's being attacked is by the methods, the way in which the death penalty is administered. And it turns out that lethal injection was brought about because it was brought about for very noble reasons. It was brought about because this would be a humane way to put people to death, if such a thing can exist. And she tells the story of a woman who in the UK who basically systematically shut off all the avenues by which American prisons can get the drugs they need to administer the death penalty. So she essentially stopped the death penalty. One woman in the UK essentially stopped the death penalty in America. And it led to a lot of arguments at the Supreme Court, and I think just at large about, are we ready to take the death penalty away? Is in fact the drugs being taken away making the death penalty more cruel and unusual, or more cruel at least? So that was a conversation we got into. So yeah, I mean, this was a story in many ways about those words in our Constitution, but oddly enough, it's about the fact that I mean, you think about the word unusual. Like, if you look in America, it's not unusual. Most Americans support the death penalty. But in the world, it is extremely unusual.
Right.
We are very much an outlier. And it is interesting to me that that being the case, you have a situation where we become a victim of globalized capitalism, basically. And our death penalty becomes embroiled in this, like, network of globalized capitalism. And that's one of the ways that Maya actually end it. So I don't know. I mean, that's sort of a long-winded answer, but that's where I came into it from.
We get to sort of, there's a Utah component to this story, and I want to play a moment from this because a state representative from Utah, Paul Ray, appears in this part of the story, and this is sort of related to in 2010, this convicted killer Ronnie Lee Gardner is executed in the Utah State Prison. By firing squad. And I should just mention, because it might be conspicuous if I don't, is that I was actually one of the media witnesses, by the way.
Actually, were you really?
Yeah, I watched this firing squad.
Wow.
Which Karen explores and she talks about. But let me play this moment from Paul Ray, and you'll hear Karen Duffin in this moment too, because this Republican state representative raises this really interesting question.
The lady that was spearheaded the getting rid of the injections, all she did is basically force people to be shot.
This is Paul Ray,
State Representative, House District 13, Utah.
He says one day he was sitting in his office.
I was actually listening to the local NPR station.
A federal judge in Oklahoma is.
And they were talking about
European pharmaceutical companies used to provide this controversial drug, but now refuse to sell it to American prisons.
The European drug company is no longer selling the drug cocktail. And so I called our Department of Corrections and said, hey, do we have access to the drug? And they said, no, we don't. You know, we have a set amount and then we're out.
He says he hung up the phone, did a little bit of thinking, a little bit of research.
Kind of deep into the history.
And eventually he came to the conclusion.
Well, let's revert back to the firing squad.
What do you mean, like firing squad, John Wayne firing squad? Like line up against the wall?
No, it's like they have a chair and they bring the person into the room and they strap them to the chair. They put a hood over their head.
A physician will locate the heart and they'll pin a target where the heart is.
And then there's five men with rifles and one of them has a blank, but none of them know which one it is.
And then when the order is given, they all shoot the individual.
In the heart.
Karen Duffin reporting that story. Ellie Mistel, would you talk about this? What's the question? Because you sort of, this gets to the point. The idea, look, if you're going to do it, just do it. Talk about
right,
this moment.
I mean, I think this really shows the limits of Supreme Court power. I think a lot of people think, even if they don't fully understand what the Supreme Court does, I think a lot of people feel that it is very powerful, and it is in certain sense, in a certain way. But here, what we see is that the Supreme Court can't actually go in, kind of state by state, and legislate for them how to do certain things. Unless the Supreme Court is willing to say that the death penalty is straight up unconstitutional, which it was in 1972 and then it changed its mind in 1976, without that absolute bar, there's still a lot of power on a state-by-state level to decide how to do this thing. The Supreme Court might not like it. The Supreme Court might think it's fine, but it doesn't have the power to go in and legislate what Utah does or what Texas does or what New York does.
Yeah.
Let's
and, you know, and to the question of like, there's something. I mean, just to be totally sort of transparent, I'm not a supporter of the death penalty, but there's something in the idea that if you're going to do it, you need to just
own it.
You need to man up. You need to face up to it. And it's like I'm killing someone. So okay, if I agree that this is something that we as a country should do, then let's just actually call it what it is. And I think what Paul Ray is saying there.
Yeah. I have to say, I felt that way too. At the moment, I mean, like seeing a firing squad execution can be brutal, but you're thinking, you know, and this is one of the things that the podcast really episode really works through. Why sanitize it? If this is what everyone agrees is we're going to do it, how we're going to do it, just do it.
Absolutely. And what we see, I think, is there are studies that show that as people actually become more familiar with the actual details of the death penalty and how it is administered, people are a little less supporting of it. And so I think that if America is going to be one of the only countries that maintains a death penalty, I think that the citizens should at least know what it is so that they can have an actual informed opinion about if they're pro or con.
We're essentially out of time. Jed, we should say the episode that drops, what, today or tomorrow? This is affirmative action we're taking up.
Yeah, we're going to – sometime in the wee hours we will release an episode that does a very deep dive into a case that was just announced a few days ago that upholds affirmative action. It turns out that case is being – and so many like it are being brought by one man sitting in an office in Tallahassee who is systematically unwinding civil rights, at least that's what his critics say. And we profile the man who does that and look at the sort of the legal issues in that case.
Ever since the case decision came out, I believe there's been a lot of misdirected online hate at the name, the plaintiff, Abigail Fisher. This episode should really, I would hope, should really help people understand kind of the man behind Abigail Fisher and the person really pushing these kinds of cases as opposed to the name plaintiff.
Ellie Mistal, contributing legal editor to More Perfect. Ellie, thanks. Glad we had you on.
Oh, thank you. Sorry for the difficulties.
Not at all. And Jed Abumrad, of course, creator, host of More Perfect, and of course, of co-host of Radiolab. Jed, thanks to you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.